loyir ne bayir shalom le boy na boy ma shem lo yishmarir shav shokat choy ma.
We've come to recognize that secularism itself is also an ideology. And it's an ideology that is not somehow neutral or a blank space, but it's a very particular social political condition that is connected to a history of Protestant Christianity and kind of thinking in those terms. And it can get very fused with capitalism. And so I think there's a growing sense among people that no matter how we live, no matter what kind of forms of life we choose for ourselves, choosing some form of life is inescapable. And there's something, I think, about Hasidism as one example in a much broader phenomenon that offers a different way, a different path that is somehow enchanting, stimulating, comforting.
If you're tired of arguing with strangers on the internet, try talking with one of them in real life.
Welcome to Back in America, the podcast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of Back in America, your podcast interrogating what it means to be part of the American experiment in the 21st century. I'm Josh Wagner, your host for today's episode. I was raised as a secular Reformed Jew, and this week I want to raise a series of questions about enchantment, belief, and religion in America today. We don't need philosophers like Friedrich Nietzsche to tell us that most Americans act as though God has died, that they are more concerned with this world than the next. To be devoutly and seriously religious as a millennial in 2021, especially if you weren't raised that way, is weird. There seems to be something wrong with you if you bring your faith home with you to roost. This week, I spoke with three white American Jews from various non-Orthodox backgrounds, who decided to become more religious and devote time to studying theological texts. Sam Shonkoff is a professor of Jewish studies at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley, California, and researches the revival of mystical religious practices in the thought of not-quite-theologian Martin Buber. I also interviewed two of his former students, Eva Sturm-Gross and Joan Gelfand, both of whom studied Judaism academically while seeking to connect with her own Reformed backgrounds. While their experience does not speak for all Jews, I want to explore several questions at the heart of American Judaism. What is missing from the secularized form of Judaism? What does it mean to be a Jew in America 60 years after the Shoah? How are American Jews dealing with the legacy of white supremacy? At the same time, American Jews have been held by white supremacy while also suffering horrific anti-Semitic attacks committed by white supremacists. What about Judaism allows these paradoxes to continue? Welcome to Back in America, Sam, Eva, and Jonah.
Thanks so much, Josh. Really a pleasure to be here.
To start off, Eva and Jonah, can you tell us a little bit more about your background in Judaism?
Before I went to college, I had been in a very secular reform setting. Both my parents are Jewish. We went to a reform temple growing up. I was bat mitzvahed at 13 by my choice. I was given the choice whether or not I wanted to be bat mitzvahed. But my personal beliefs were like nihilist. I was very fascinated with religion, but from a kind of removed point of view. And then when I got to college, the big turning point for me was an academic course on Jewish mysticism. It was through that academic study that I was able to explore Judaism from this totally new perspective and begin to see where my beliefs and my worldview and my whole identity could be seen through this perspective, and that how I could have a relationship with the divine using these laws and these writings that have been in my people's past for generations and generations.
Chappaqua is these days, I don't know what the actual percentage is, but it felt like 80% Jewish. That's actually not true. I've learned more recently, but growing up, I just assumed it was. Most of my friends I went to synagogue and Hebrew school with. Despite it being a large Jewish community, to me, it did not feel like the strongest Jewish community in that it wasn't fostering a sense of continual engagement in the kids. So I was a pretty peculiar kid in that I continued going to Hebrew school after my bar mitzvah. And that was only because my mother made me. And thank God she did. I'm happy about it now. But at the time, it was not something I wanted to be doing. There were probably 100 kids right before bar mitzvah. And then by eighth grade, there were 15 in Hebrew school. So it was a huge shift. And that's very, very common. And it, what's even more common is that by the end of Hebrew school, I had totally kind of renounced Judaism. Not that formally, but for my first year of college, I very purposely did not go to high holiday services or anything as kind of like a, now I'm on my own, I don't have to do this. But the cultural side is huge. Getting to Oberlin, the people I were drawn to were other Jews because we had that common, the common reference points. And it was only after leaving that I realized that it was important to me. It was only after going to college that I realized how central Judaism was to me.
Thanks for sharing, Eva and Jonah. Sam, could you tell us a bit about what it means to be a Hasidic Jew, especially for those who are totally unfamiliar with Judaism?
It's a complicated question. Hasidism today, when most people hear that word, if they even recognize that word, what probably immediately comes to mind is this image of the so-called black hat, usually a male Jew with a big beard and the payas or side curls, probably wearing a black hat, as that nickname goes, a suit. And this image has become at once kind of a symbol of Jewish authenticity and Jewish extremism at the same time, when there's sort of stereotypical images of a religious Jew, say in the media, in a movie, in a show, they will more often than not be a Hasidic Jew, and actually became in many ways a radical countercultural movement for its time. It was banned by many of the establishment rabbinic authorities of the time. It was a mystical movement. It had strongly populist aspects to it, kind of anti-elitist aspects to it. It was highly gender segregated and patriarchal. It was sort of a spiritual fraternity. Every human being, regardless of their educational background, regardless of whether they were a scholar or a shoemaker, had a sort of immediate access to the divine. And in a mystical sense, the key word here is dvekut, literally means to be sort of almost fused with the divine, and that it, this requires actually a dynamism, a spontaneity, a sort of open receptivity of consciousness, in some ways appealing to a lot of young Jews, but really continued to spread, especially throughout the 19th century in Eastern Europe, and was just unimaginably decimated in the Holocaust. But somehow, seeds of it really sprouted and continued to flourish, especially in the United States and Israel, and continues to actually grow quite rapidly to this day.
It's complicated because there's such an emphasis on just like doing commandments as participating in the religion. And at the same time, the religion is kind of also an ethnicity that you're born into. So like what defines it? Women for many, many years would be only speaking Yiddish and would also be participating in the religion in kind of a similar way, where they're doing these mitzvot, but not really having like access to this, like the actual text or like what is actually being said. Most men would have been able to understand the Hebrew. But the emphasis is really on just like doing the commandments. And at the same time, personally, I kind of like started doing commandments because I got really into studying the texts. I feel like I don't really have like any kind of answer. I just think like the question itself is like really interesting and complicated.
What I found missing in Judaism growing up was literally any sense of spirituality. Anything, you know, anything that connected me to something. There were moments when I felt like there was something beyond myself and I wasn't given the tools to understand, and not only understand, but to talk about, to experience, to experience that again. Like what happens in those moments when you are experiencing something beyond yourself, right? There is, and that's not only in synagogue, right? You think about it, the moments of really deep connection, interpersonal connection between people. Something happens there that's beyond the two people there. You know, you think about the moments of taking a beautiful hike and you're on top of a mountain and you look out and there's something else happening there. It's not just that you're looking at a mountain. You know, there's something beyond that. Jewish mysticism talks about God not as something outside of the world, but something inside the world, something that you are experiencing between people, among people. You're experiencing it in your everyday life.
As you're talking about the appeal of this alternative to religion, to liberalism, to rationality, I'm thinking of Netflix's Unorthodox. One unique aspect of that miniseries is how seriously it takes religion and religious community in a way that it seems is pretty rare on television.
What was your experience watching this show?
I had one of these experiences watching Unorthodox where throughout the whole thing, I was feeling, on one hand, very critical of it and saying, oh, you're getting this wrong. Like, this is totally inaccurate. This is almost maybe offensive. This is like problematic. And then on the other hand, like, of course I was crying during the audition scene at that crescendo moment where she's singing and it's beautiful. And so I was caught up with it while also being critical. I was reading a lot of reviews of it, especially from people who grew up in that Satmar Hasidic world, partly because I was interested to, you know, I am not Hasidic myself. But one of the most interesting comments that I saw in one of these reviews was from a woman who left the Satmar Hasidic world precisely because she just could no longer stand being in this black and white world where there was the good and the bad, there were the sacred community and the satanic community. That was one of the things that really was repulsive to her. And she said this show, Unorthodox, did that same thing, but just from a secular perspective, that the world that I chose to leave, which was, of course, a complicated world. It was complicated. There were aspects that were horrible and suffocating and oppressive, and there were aspects that were warm and beautiful. That complexity for her didn't, it kind of got distilled out of the portrayal of the Satmar Hasidic community in that show. And similarly, and this was something that I was quite struck by, this secular sphere in Berlin that she ends up in, this group of friends, and was like out of a Gap commercial. It literally was too good to be true. Everyone is smoking hot. Everyone is emotionally attuned and sensitive and supportive. Maybe at times they're a little too honest with you, but you'll fall in love and you'll have this warm sense of connectedness within days in this community, even if you're totally culturally, even linguistically, an outsider. You know, that's not true. That is not really how the world works. So I thought that it was very telling about this human tendency to just oversimplify and to have sort of the lightness versus the darkness. And whether people are doing that in the context of religion or whether people are doing that in the context of a kind of glorified secularism, that tends to happen nonetheless. It's really difficult to find any kind of social form, any kind of movement, any kind of vision of a redeemed world that doesn't use some other as a shadow.
So assimilation makes us think that the Jews who are doing Judaism Jewishly, for lack of a better term, are the ones who are really giving it away. You know, like, we've done a really good job blending in, and here are these people wearing black hats and tzitzis, and they're giving it away for us. You know, like, you know, you can't fit in as much in the world if you can't hang out on Saturday.
Yeah, I love it if you could talk about a positive vision of Hasidism, and especially why this movement and many other more conservative religions are growing today.
Part of the draw towards communities such as these Hasidic ones is that they offer a well-defined sort of mode of life and how you ought to live and who you ought to marry and what you ought to do for work and what you should do from morning till night. Whereas the outside world, as it were, that is chaotic and filled with indecision and sort of seemingly infinite paths and value systems. Why Hasidic communities are growing for the most part is a tricky one. And I think that, you know, in some ways it's a similar question to why are other relatively conservative segments of religious life in general, even in Christian or Muslim, say, folds? Like, why are these the ones that are actually growing, it seems, in many cases more rapidly than the so-called liberal or progressive religious spheres within those traditions? This is not something that any person can understand fully. Evidently, you know, if you look around the world, if you look at history, and for many of us, even if we look within ourselves, we see that rational investigations and scientific analysis may be incredibly dear to our heart, but that's not everything. We have need for community. We have need for moments of transcendence. We have needs to connect in different ways, to connect with the enchantment and the mysteriousness of being and what it is to be here in this time between birth and death.
I think it's a mistake to think of a life of religiosity as archaic or backwards. I think that secular liberalism has a worldview that wants to typecast religiosity in this way. And obviously, there are some parts of religious Judaism that I, as like a queer person, can't do all the mitzvot. But I think it's important to remember that like the religion of Judaism is based off of physical actions and text more than anything. And the physical actions are the commandments, the 613 commandments. The Chabad rabbi loves to use this sports metaphor where he's like, let's say everyone's on a football field, right? And you can throw in the ball backwards. You can be doing this play or this play or this play. But if you're not on the field, you're not playing the game. And he thinks of the edges of the field as halacha, the mitzvah. So if you're not engaging with the commandments, if you're not doing the commandments, you're not even on the field. I don't know if that metaphor completely works for me. But I do think that there's something really important about religion and Judaism, especially engaging with the commandments that are being asked of you.
So I was raised in the Reform movement, the secular side of the Reform movement, purely cultural, not really interested in people engaging in a deeper way. Again, there was no intention of people engaging deeper. And in fact, the people who did engage deeper were weird. I thought it was weird when kids stayed longer or wanted to do more, be more involved. I thought that was weird. The people who I study with and who I engage with in terms of Judaism are folks who are trying to live more traditionally, oftentimes people who weren't raised like that and are trying to move towards that as well, like myself. But all my family and friends from growing up and for most of college were not like that. So I live in this space between those two worlds. What I'll say is that I see the dichotomy as falsely constructed. I see it as the result of about 150 years of Jewish assimilation into the quote-unquote American dream through the assimilation have lost a lot, I personally think.
There also seems to be a strong link between being Jewish and ethics. In my local temple, my rabbi is always getting up on the bima and talking about the ethical lessons of Torah, and I'm curious where that emphasis on the ethical comes from.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, like even this kind of genre of sermon that you're describing, where the kind of essence of Judaism is ethics, that it all comes back to ethics, that in itself is a very distinctively modern approach to thinking about Judaism, and in itself, very much emerged in a particular political context where Jews in late 18th century through the 19th century were essentially, in the European context, were struggling for citizenship and civil rights, what's called emancipation. And they basically were in a position where they had to convince their Christian neighbors and the Christian powers that Judaism was compatible with the modern nation state, that it wasn't a separate nation. It wasn't going to be a state within a state. It wasn't essentially a separate legal system that might be in conflict with the legal system of that state, but it was no more and no less than a so-called religion, where religion is defined in a kind of Protestant sense. And Judaism as a religion would primarily be a sort of private, inward way of being, discourse, set of rituals, but not laws, that would ultimately make Jews exceptionally civil and sort of beneficial citizens. So it was Judaism, the essence of Judaism, according to this kind of 19th century discourse, was ethical monotheism, to use the language of that era. So I think it's a great example of how, like, any approach to religion or spirituality we take is always already political, whether we realize it or not. Today, you know, we're seeing something similar. I think there's a lot of Jews who are obviously, you know, disenfranchised with Judaism and don't want to have much to do with it. There's also a lot of, I mean, I'm really interested in what I see is a kind of Jewish religious counterculture that's also emerging, like people who really identify as radical, as leftist, as progressive, who are really integrating that political identity, those political visions, with Jewishness and what it means to be Jewish and what it means to, say, have a Shabbat dinner or to study Torah or Talmud, to think about what Jewish politics ought to look like or not look like. And similarly, I don't think that those of us who are in that sphere would say that we are kind of assimilating Judaism to the leftist progressive politics of our time. But I think, you know, I think that is what we are doing on some level. Those acts of assimilation can also be where some of it can be the wellsprings of religious renewal and innovation. And there's countless examples of that. I think we'd be hard pressed to find any like vibrant transformative movement in Jewish history that wasn't also a profound practice of assimilation. it's partly what it means to also be a diasporic community that's constantly kind of navigating tensions between a tradition and particular time and place in the broader world.
I just remember Sam talking about Torah as this kind of like living collection of words and ideas that could like bubble up through the surface and be kind of like transmuted and recreated, and how like the kind of vibrancy and vitality of the living document of Torah. And I think that was like the first moment when I was like, okay, I'm gonna stay here and see what happens.
My friends from high school, and I'm talking about the stuff I'm learning, it blows them away, because it blew me away as well. You know, how is this stuff not shown to us growing up? This is what's gonna make people wanna be Jewish, not just bagels and lox. Yes, of course, bagels and lox are great, but that's not it, you know, that can't be it. It's not that they formulated these laws and figured out the specifics of everything to make life harder. They did it because it worked. They did it because when you do things a certain way, it puts you into specific states of consciousness that are quite literally altered states of consciousness that enable you to engage with the divine to an easier level, right? So it's not that you should lay tefillin because, it's not only that you should lay tefillin because it's tradition. Yes. Part of the amazing thing about me, and I don't know if tefillin is the listeners will, it's this, it's translated in King James Bible as phylacteries, but it's like this thing that you tie around your arm during prayer, and it has specific verses from the Torah on your arm and on your forehead. And traditionally, a Jew will lay tefillin once a day and pray with it on. So it's not only that you do that because traditionally Jews have done it. There's something really beautiful just with the fact that when I put on my tefillin in the morning, for the past 2,500 years, every, at least from at most 99.9999% of at least male Jews have laid tefillin every day, you know, for 2,500 years. It's not just that. And obviously, the gender stuff is something that is shifting and changing and needs to be played around with and reworked and rethought to make it more egalitarian, in my opinion. But it's not just about the tradition. It's also that doing that, for some reason, physiologically changes your body. You know, the prayers are said in such a way that for some reason, if I'm wearing my talis and I'm wearing tefillin and I'm saying the specific prayer at this time and closing my eyes and doing it in this way and breathing in this way, you experience something different.
One question in the back of my mind throughout our conversation has been the connection between Zionism and being Jewish. It seems that for lots of young Jews today, Israel and the whole question of Jewish nationalism just isn't as important as the day-to-day or other tenets of the faith. And I'm curious if you could talk about the connection between being Jewish today and Zionism.
It's taking it further than it was taken in the 60s and really calling more fundamentally into question than ever before the notion of ethnic nationalism. The very idea that there should be any particular ethnic religious identity associated with a state is being really pushed upon and called into question now in ways that personally I think is extraordinarily important. And I think it is calling into question the very foundation, the very historical foundations of these countries, including the United States, and of course, including Israel. Jews have both been subject to discrimination, anti-Semitism. You know, the memory of the Holocaust or the Shoah is really not that long ago. While at the same time recognizing the fact that at the very least, Ashkenazi Jews of European descent who pass as white in this country have benefited undeniably from white privilege and white supremacy. And both of those things are true. And I think that for the most part, really confronting this overwhelming benefit of white privilege among American Jews. Again, not all Jews are white, and I want to constantly refer to that and not overlook that. But the vast majority of Jews in this country have benefited from white privilege and have had a hard time looking at that. And I think that makes Zionism a lot more complicated. In the European context, in these like late 19th century, early 20th century states where Jews were in a lot of ways like the paradigmatic oppressed, marginalized minority within those borders, excluding, of course, the colonies throughout the world of those European states. That was a very different context. But in the United States, there's just no way to argue that Jews have been the most or even one of the top few most oppressed people in the States. And I know that statement will make some people feel uncomfortable, and it should make us feel uncomfortable when we start to compare suffering in this way. But we also have to look at the reality.
I mean, it's complicated, right? Because, like, there are these kind of, like, these assumptions about what it means to be a religious Jew and in regards to the Holocaust and Zionism. And with the Holocaust, it's like that trauma is like so real for the American Jewry. And, you know, all these studies on epigenetics show it, right? It makes sense that Jews are like super freaked out about it. And I think with Zionism and the Holocaust, the way I think about it, because it's like not, yeah, it's like not as like real and present for me. Like I am pretty anti-Zionist. I'm pretty religious, but I'm also pretty anti-Zionist. And I don't think those two things in any way are in conflict with each other for me. Like I think the state of Israel is pretty, I don't know if I'm allowed to say fucked up, but I think the state of Israel is pretty fucked up. And there's like a contingency of religious Jews who are anti-Zionist. And for me, when I usually think of things first and foremost theologically. And when I think about it theologically, it kind of comes down to this really big concept in Judaism and Jewish mysticism of exile. And that's kind of with the Holocaust too, and like what it means to be an American Jew and what it means to be a Jew in general is about exile. And it starts with like the first exile, the exile from Eden, which is like, you know, the original sin, the exile from God. But then there's these like constant moments of exile that are like so deeply ingrained in the Jewish ethos, like multiple exiles from the temple, destruction of the temple, when a lot of these like really formative writings were created. Then there's like, you know, like expulsion from Spain. There's like, Holocaust, there's like so many moments of exile, and it kind of like that became really ingrained in these Jewish texts and in like the conception of our relationship as people to God and in God from God's self. Like within the theology of Judaism, and if we think about it from like the perspective of this really big mystic, Isaac Luria, he has like this whole thing about like that we are in exile from God, but at the same time, the feminine divine is in exile from the masculine divine. Perform tikkun olam, which is the reparation of the world. And what that means is like putting together these like broken shards that came from that kind of violent moment of exile. And when we put them together, then God will be united with God's self and we will be united with God. And like, that's the messianic moment. But until that happens, we're living in this kind of broken world. And so, and with the responsibility of reparations. So I feel like, and we're not supposed to really go back to Israel until that kind of like moment of unity happens, and it hasn't happened yet. So I feel like I don't feel super attached to Israel and going back there right now.
There is a double sense in which being a Jew is part of the fabric of American identity. Yet at the same time, anti-Semitism is on the rise. On my college campus alone, there were myriad graffiti or swastikas. America seems to both accept and put pressure on what it means to be a Jew. How do you balance the tension between those internal doubts and external attacks on American Jewishness?
The world is always more complicated than we think it is, and this is one of those times, right? That like, right as many of us are thinking as deeply and critically as we can about ways in which Jews such as myself, who are Ashkenazi of European descent, have benefited, and our families for generations have benefited from white privilege. We're also living during a time with a rise of anti-Semitism, and right, swastikas being drawn on college campuses, and anti-Semitism coming from kind of all sides. There is undeniably a rise of anti-Semitism right now. It's not only tragic and sad because it being a target is tragic and sad. That goes without saying. I think something that also makes it tragic and frankly dangerous is that oftentimes when you really look carefully at discourses that target Jews and put up, say, the stereotype of like the powerful Jews pulling the strings, which is, of course, this dominant trope. When you really look carefully at where that is happening, it is oftentimes masking a really important, even more disturbing feature of reality. So, for example, when a lot of poor and working class white Americans are chanting, "Jews will not replace us," and taking on a white nationalist movement that targets Jews, among other people, that is masking the fact that it's not actually George Soros who's your problem. It's corporate America that is screwing you and our entire economy, that has completely hijacked the political systems in our government, especially the Republican Party, and actually people like Donald Trump are actually the ones who are screwing you. They are like the economic disparities in this country, the sense that you've been left behind. We actually can talk about this, right? This if when we when that devolves into conspiracy theories about powerful Jews who are subjugating you and funneling money away from you and who are supporting a kind of pluralistic vision of America with all these people of color who are going to, and immigrants and refugees who are going to take your jobs. Like those kinds of conspiracy theories and anti-Semitic kind of fantasies are actually diverting attention from the real revolution that has to happen. And it falls straight into the hands of people like Donald Trump and his cronies who are trying to keep us down. And so this is, it makes it even more complicated that sometimes the accusations to other people being anti-Semitic. That also sometimes is masking really important realities we need to look at. When, you know, when the so-called squad, Ayanna Pressley and Ilhan Omar and AOC, you know, have been recently, like just in the past week since the insurrection, where they've been calling for racial justice and denouncing white supremacy, Trumpists have gone on a rampage accusing them of being anti-Semitic. And it's like, you know, talk about a blatant example of a claim of anti-Semitism also sometimes masking an important reality that we need to look at here, namely racism and white supremacy in this country.
Thank you so, so much for taking the time to talk to me today about all of these things. I really appreciate hearing your perspective.
Thank you, Josh. This was a really fascinating conversation with you. Sure.